From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. So Elizabeth Warren may need some ice packs today. She took a lot of verbal punches in last night's Democratic debate. No one laid a glove on Joe Biden when it came to Ukraine. And Bernie Sanders had a heart attack? Hard to tell. 12 Democratic candidates met for 3 hours in the all-important swing state of Ohio. Healthcare was hot. Immigration hardly mentioned, except for Julian Castro's line about Donald Trump letting ISIS prisoners escape in Syria while caging immigrant children on the U.S. border. Let's bring in NPR's political correspondent Asma Khalid. And Asma, Elizabeth Warren, she rose in the polls to match Joe Biden, and one result, tag, she was it last night.
Mm-hmm. That's right. I mean, she came under scrutiny, I would say, from so many sides. Specifically, the night began, or I would say after sort of a little bit of questioning around impeachment, we moved very quickly to health care. And Elizabeth Warren has often said when she's pushed on health care questions that she's with Bernie, saying that she's supportive of Bernie Sanders' Medicare for All plan. But some of the candidates said that they sort of wanted more from her. They felt like she was being evasive, that she's not offering that much clarity on this. And most specifically, they say she has not explicitly acknowledged that taxes would likely increase if we were to adopt a Medicare for All plan. She essentially feels like that's a disingenuous question, that total health care costs would go down, so she doesn't want to go there.
Yeah, she says the money will go to pay for other things. But here's Senator Klobuchar of Minnesota.
At least Bernie's being honest here and saying how he's going to pay for this and that taxes are going to go up. And I'm sorry, Elizabeth, but you have not said that, and I think we owe it to the American people to tell them where we're going to send the invoice.
So she, Elizabeth Warren, was taking most of those verbal, you know, hits. How did she handle it in your mind?
You know, that's a really interesting question, Rob. I think that she definitely seemed flustered at times by the sort of onslaught of attacks, and in part because they weren't just from one direction. We had Amy Klobuchar, we had the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, Pete Buttigieg, also multiple times push Elizabeth Warren and say, you've got a plan for everything. How is it that you have not articulated a plan for healthcare, and more specifically, how you intend to pay for this all? Mm. And these are lines of attacks, in some ways, I would say she should have been prepared for. Many of the candidates have been previewing these criticisms for weeks ahead of the debate. Mm. But look, this is the turf that she has to play on at this point. To me, it was also an acknowledgement across the board from candidates that they now see Elizabeth Warren as a very clear threat and as the potential frontrunner, because we did not see so many direct jabs at the former vice president, Joe Biden, as we saw directed at Elizabeth Warren.
Well, let's skip to Joe Biden. This debate came after weeks of President Trump and Rudy Giuliani telling falsehoods about Joe Biden, claiming he had a Ukrainian prosecutor fired because the prosecutor was investigating a company Biden's son was on the board of. In fact, Biden and others wanted the prosecutor to investigate more. But Biden's son, Hunter, also said this week it was wrong for him to be on that board. The optics are terrible. Anderson Cooper did ask one question of Biden, but did you get the sense Biden, if the candidate, could handle this topic on the stage with Donald Trump?
Gosh, that's a really tough question to answer, I think, Robin, in part because I was fascinated by the brevity of this entire moment in the debate last night. You're right that Anderson Cooper asked one question to Joe Biden about this. Joe Biden very quickly said, essentially, I did nothing wrong. My son did nothing wrong. And he wants the conversation to be focused on Donald Trump. What I was fascinated by was the degree to which the moderators did not pose any of these questions to any of the other candidates. So we don't know essentially how Donald Trump would handle this in a debate Joe Biden would handle this in a debate because he wasn't piled on this issue. There was just one single question from a moderator, and then they quickly changed gears, shifted the conversation.
In fact, Cory Booker came back later and said he thought it was an insult that it was even asked because it was based on a falsehood. But Republicans are saying Anderson Cooper should have pushed harder. So that sits there. Bernie Sanders seemed to be very vigorous despite having had a heart attack a couple weeks ago. But just you mentioned the impeachment question. Candidates gave a range of responses. Where did they seem to be in agreement?
There's really unanimous agreement that they all feel this impeachment inquiry should be moving forward in the House. They feel like it's necessary. I mean, there's gradations when they're asked about this, whether or not they feel like this process needs to sort of play out through the appropriate mechanisms in Congress, or whether they're sort of like Elizabeth Warren, who has been very vocally calling for impeachment for months ever since the Mueller report came out.
All right, quick lightning round. Who might we not see in the near future after last night?
After last night, I mean, so to to that question, Robin, a number of candidates actually are still in this race who were not on the stage last night. I think of, for example, Montana Governor Steve Bullock. There's a whole bunch of them who were not actually on stage. Come November, the donor threshold, as well as the polling requirement that candidates will need to make it onto stage, become higher. They're stricter requirements. And so as a result, that's why we saw someone like an Amy Klobuchar from Minnesota punching up at times because she has not yet qualified for that November debate. Mm. That being said, I don't anticipate all the candidates who won't make that debate to necessarily drop out. Some of them have, you know, been building up operations in Iowa and New Hampshire.
We'll see. NPR political correspondent Asma Khalid, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan says he will never declare a ceasefire in northeast Syria, defying international pressure and threats of sanctions from the U.S. Turkey invaded Kurdish-controlled northern Syria earlier this month following President Trump's decision to withdraw U.S. troops. When asked about the Turkish operation today in a press gathering in the Oval Office, the president said, quote, "It's not our problem." Let's bring in NPR correspondent Daniel Estrin. He's in the city of Dohuk in northern Iraq. Daniel, on Sunday, Kurdish forces partnered with the Syrian army to combat Turkey's invasion. How has this alliance shifted things on the ground?
It's created a vacuum because U.S. troops are moving out and Syrian troops are moving in. And there's a lot of panic among international aid organizations, especially. One aid worker told us that almost all aid groups are pulling out their international staff out of northeast Syria. It's become too dangerous to be there with all the fighting, and also too risky because the Syrian regime is said to be taking control eventually of the entire border area. And if they do take control, these aid groups have been operating in the region without regime permission. And so they've been literally burning their documents to destroy evidence of who have been there for their own security. And they're also worried about their local aid staff getting in trouble. And then aside from the Syrian regime troops moving in, Russia is playing a major role here. Russia has been an ally of the Syrian regime. It's been fighting along the regime for many years. The Russians are the ones who actually brokered the deal between the Kurdish forces and the Syrian regime. There's even one video on Twitter, apparently a Russian reporter embedded with Russian troops in Syria, showing himself standing at an abandoned U.S. base in Syria. He even presses a button to operate a checkpoint barrier, and you see a dog kind of wandering around. It's a remarkable visual and symbolizes the shift in power, the U.S. out, and Russia playing a bigger role.
Mm. Vice President Mike Pence is leading a delegation to Turkey this week, but it really sounds like he's going to get a cold reception. Erdogan, as we said, won't agree to a ceasefire until the Kurdish militia, which we should also point out he views as a terrorist group, leaves northern Syria. What are you hearing about prospects for a ceasefire, if at all?
No sign of a ceasefire yet. A U.S. official told me that Turkish-led forces are still carrying out their offensive. And in fact, yesterday, an official said that Turkish-backed forces came very close to a base where U.S. forces were and put those U.S. forces directly at risk, violating an agreement with the U.S. not to get close enough to threaten U.S. troops on the ground. So still a lot of tension here. And the ones who have been fighting on the ground are actually not Turkish completely themselves. They're militias who are Syrian Arabs. Some of them had been driven out of this area, and they have a motivation to keep fighting because they want to come home.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the international aid groups on the ground and how risky it is for them. You've been reporting on this impact of the fighting and the impact that it's had on people who live there. Tell us about some of the people you've met over the last few days.
Well, it's been really heartbreaking meeting people fleeing their homes. As we were driving into Syria, we saw pickup trucks on the side of the road packed with mattresses, and we pulled over, and we met a family of more than 20 people, led by a 70-year-old man, the patriarch, and he said that they were fleeing heavy fighting in their town, and they were on the run for the last 3 days. They were sleeping in the desert. And he said his sons were not with him. They were stuck in a town with heavy fighting where the roads were cut off. And he said they are surrounded in their town. And then he broke down crying, and he wiped away his tears with a scarf on his head. And it's just horrible to see a grandfather cry. And we met another grandfather at the very end of our trip who was also crying. He was kissing his 4-year-old grandson goodbye. His grandson was crossing the border into Iraq, fleeing the violence with his mother. And the grandfather said he didn't know when he'd see his grandson again.
So many stories like that at the border there, and a very chaotic scene, I can imagine.
Yes, and as we were leaving Syria, crossing the border, we met many reporters who were, I have to say, teary-eyed, and they were reflecting on the fact that this could be a closing window on Syria if the Syrian regime comes and takes over this border crossing, and it really feels like a momentous point in history.
That's NPR correspondent Daniel Estrin speaking to us from northern Iraq near the border with Turkey and Syria. Daniel, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
This message comes from NPR sponsor MindBody. MindBody connects millions to the widest variety of local fitness classes, and they offer the same experience when it comes to massage and acupuncture, spas and salons. Find, book, and pay all in one place. Owners can join the network at mindbodyonline.com/NPR. MindBody, your access to the largest consumer wellness network and marketplace.
Back in 2016, during the Republican National Convention in Cleveland, we took a tour of the neighborhoods hit hard by the 2008 housing collapse. Cleveland is beautiful, but there were still swaths of abandoned, crumbling homes. Well, recently we went back to see what's changed. The answer, not much. We'll have pictures at hereandnow.org, but come with us as we visit again, starting at Cleveland's Greater Collinwood Development Corporation, where we met up with the city's longest-serving city councilor, Michael Palencic, who represents East Cleveland's 8th Ward and is trying to get some of the worst blight taken down. Okay, we've stepped outside the office here.
The Greater Collinwood Development Corporation.
Yep.
So you can see right directly across the street, this was an old dairy that had been taken down because it was abandoned. Same thing right over there was a single family home on that lot. So as we're out and about, you'll see there's been a great deal of demolition. Unfortunately, it's not enough. I have approximately just around 300 structures that need to come down.
Isn't that one of the debates, though? There are some people who don't want homes taken down. They want them rehabbed, but the cost is phenomenal.
Well, it goes back to that old saying, you can fix anything and repair anything, but the question is, if homes are selling in the $40,000 to $50,000 price range on a given street, and to rehab that structure is $80,000, then it doesn't make any economic sense.
But can you get people to build if it's a lot?
Since the meltdown 2007-2008, I haven't had a new house built in our community.
Not one new house. But who would build on a block with zombies? We'll explain. Michael says no one will take responsibility. And in time, the houses around the blighted buildings also plummet in value.
They do. We have a situation in Ohio where the banking industry has had a great deal of influence and power. So when they foreclose on an individual, they do not have to put the property in their name. They evict the resident. The house sits there empty, but it's not in the name of the bank.
The bank's not responsible.
The bank is not responsible for maintenance. So that's why the city of Cleveland has to spend over $2 million a year cutting grass.
You know, people might say, well, go get those people who are evicted. Jail them. Fine them.
All those people know is that they're out of their home. And many of them find a rude awakening because all of a sudden, now you start prosecution, and who comes up? Them.
They may think that foreclosure means it's not yours anymore.
That's exactly. And now they're being told somehow you're responsible to cut the grass and maintain it. Well, wait a minute. I haven't lived there for 3 years. What are you talking about?
Why are these foreclosures happening? Is it because people got loans that they shouldn't have? This is, you know, the old story.
There's no doubt predatory lending. When we walk right to the corner here, you're going to see newer homes that were built by our development corporation here. One of those homes sold, I think it was for $242,000. It went into foreclosure. What did the person put down on the home? $42.13.
And they were given a loan.
They were given a loan.
So people got loans that shouldn't have. Many have been evicted. But Councilman Polensic says current homeowners who want to stay but need to fix up their homes can't because they can't get loans. It's like the illegal practice of redlining.
I believe it's redlining by community, by zip code. Does racial consideration still factor in some cases? Without a doubt. But if you look at it in general, my ward is racially and ethnically diverse. It's predominantly African-American. But I could show you Caucasian families will tell you the same thing. They can't get a loan. They can't improve their property.
So we start a drive through Councilman Polensic's district. I ask him why people abandon now, 10 years after the housing collapse.
The economy, contrary to what some people think, is still very, very rough in neighborhoods like this. This community on the northeast side of the city of Cleveland lost, it all depends who you talk to, between 20 and 25,000 manufacturing jobs. We have over 4,000 abandoned structures in the city right now. And Cleveland is under 400,000 in population.
But why is it happening? Is it people who can't make their mortgage payments?
They can't make their mortgage payments, or they have fallen so far behind on their taxes, they don't put another dime into the property. And then at some point, they just leave it. So the county has done a terrible job of collecting taxes. We have the worst collection record in the state, Cuyahoga County. And what happens is where we talk about these homes sitting vacant for years. That's a vacant house right there. So you had predatory lending. Then you had absentee landlords who virtually milked the property. And then the county, where we could have saved these structures, had there been a reasonable foreclosure process, these properties went on for years and years. Here's another abandoned one sitting right here.
You say there's not a reasonable foreclosure process.
The county collects taxes, property taxes. So the county doesn't collect the property tax. Had they collected or had they foreclosed within a reasonable period of time, you wouldn't have houses sitting 6, 7, 8, 9 years vacant. So those houses would have gone in for a sheriff's sale and would have been sold and put back into productive use. So it's been a vicious cycle in this city and in this county.
It is amazing. We see freestanding homes, attached three-deckers, whole apartment buildings.
So that's abandoned. That's abandoned. That house is abandoned. The one thing that has worked is the creation of the Cuyahoga County Land Bank. If it wasn't for the land bank, God only knows where we'd be at. This is another abandoned one right here.
And what does that do?
The Cuyahoga County Land Bank is the clearinghouse. They take abandoned structures once they go through the foreclosure process and or vacant land. And then they can sell it off for private development, but the land bank is only as successful as the amount of properties that come to them. When the county fails to collect property taxes, it starts a chain reaction, a domino effect, a neighborhood disinvestment, neighborhood despair. Now, do I want to see people's homes get foreclosed on? No, I don't. But at the end of the day, look at the end result. It's a system that broke down, that failed. And as a result, those people who live here, who are attempting to play by the rules, they wound up getting screwed because the value of their homes has diminished substantially. The state of Ohio has to have laws in effect that if you foreclose on somebody, you put the house in your name. Because if not, that creates what we call the zombie mortgage.
The zombie mortgage, when homeowners believe they no longer hold the title to their property because they've been evicted. And lenders, banks, wash their hands of the home, take a loss, yes, but don't have to do upkeep or pay taxes because they know the homeowner does still hold the deed. As we just heard, many states require the bank name on the deed. Ohio does not. So the mortgages are, well, zombies. We drive by a small, well-maintained home next to an overgrown empty lot to find the Morrises. Mrs. Morris tending the lawn, her husband Archie beside her.
Hi, sir. Hi. We're doing a story on all the amount of homes that have been abandoned.
Yes.
And we just wondered, you're taking such good care of this home. I wondered if you had any thoughts about
my
that.
Wife,
yeah. Well, what's it like to live with so many homes boarded up, falling
apart? It's terrible. They need it because people are getting killed in them houses. raped and beat up and all kind of dope fiends, crackheads. They need to make a change. There's got to be a change somewhere.
Well, I see you and your wife here. She's carefully seeding your lawn. You've got beautiful picket fence and all these decorations.
Yeah, we try to keep it together, but, you know, people ain't going to let it stay. They throw trash all in your yard because your yard clean.
We can see where you mow up to this lot. Was there a house there that was taken down?
Yes, there was a house over there, and it's been years. Right, it's been demolished, so it's been an empty lot.
Well, I'm sure, would you rather have the zombie houses taken down? Because then you're going to have empty lots? I mean, which is better?
Well, if they take them down, what they can do is board it all the way around, fence it. Somebody might want to put a store there or anything. Yeah. But they got to keep that up.
Archie Morris tells us he's considered leaving but wouldn't be able to sell. No one is buying. So for now, they'll stand out as a beacon of hope in a desperate neighborhood. As we leave, we pause at a demolition site, tractors and backhoes tearing down a small, abandoned apartment building.
Nobody is more frustrated than I am about dealing with this stuff, because I see, historically, as a senior member of City Council, I see what this has done to my community. Every one of these empty lots, that's a property that isn't paying taxes to support our schools. This is pure insanity here. But it's man-made. See, again, we weren't hit by Hurricane Katrina or by Hurricane Michael or whatever. This was a man-made natural disaster that came through the city of Cleveland and other areas. Now, did other areas survive much better? Because of the state laws they had on the books, especially as it pertains to the zombie mortgages. And again, the taxpayers have paid the ultimate price for this.
Our visit to Cleveland City Councilor Michael Polensek's 8th Ward, which he's represented since 1978, he's convinced with new banking regulations and quicker action on tax delinquency, this can be fixed. But meanwhile, remember Archie Morris? It's obvious. He doesn't want to disappear along with his zombie neighborhood. He very much wanted you to hear his music. So, from the sidewalk, surrounded by zombie homes, here's a taste.
And we're coming to the music. That's the beginning.
That's a nice guitar. Mm-hmm. You from here originally?
Mm-hmm. Sound like Santana.
Yes, you do.
Right. And then I come in.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes. Set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
In another move that weakens environmental protections, the Trump administration is signaling it wants to expand logging access in Alaska's Tongass National Forest. The Tongass is often referred to as the crown jewel of the U.S. Forest Service and the most intact temperate rainforest in the world. State officials actually applaud this move, however. Many have wanted to see an end to Clinton-era rules that limit logging and road construction in the forest, saying that those restrictions hurt the local economy. Joining us now is Liz Ruskin, Washington correspondent for Alaska Public Media. Hi, Liz.
Hi, Tanya.
Well, Liz, first we want to ask, for those who are not familiar with the Tongass, can you tell us a little bit more about it?
Sure. It's the largest national forest in the Forest Service in the nation. It covers a very large area. It's about 500 miles. It's the entire panhandle of Alaska, pretty much. So if you've been on a cruise to Alaska, likely you've been in the Tongass.
Yes, yes, yes. Those familiar with those cruises will be familiar with that. There is this roadless rule from 2001. The U.S. Department of Agriculture announced its proposal to exempt the Tongass from the rule yesterday. What exactly does this entail, and what does the Trump administration want to change?
Well, ever since the Tongass, or ever since the roadless rule went into effect, it's been the subject of a lot of disputes and lawsuits. And so the Trump administration wants to lift the rule entirely.
And this would basically open up the ability for logging, for road construction, really to develop what is a forest at this point.
It would lift this one layer of protection or onerous regulation, if you prefer to see it that way. But there would be a lot of steps left before a road could go in or a new area opened up to logging. There's the timber sale. There's the environmental review for any road. There's a lot of steps left to go.
I see. So this is the first step, but a significant step. The argument has been that it will help the local economy. What other things have you heard from folks there?
Yeah, this area of Southeast used to have a thriving timber economy, logging economy, and there's little of it left for a variety of reasons. It has shrunk down to just a ghost of its former self. So there are many local business leaders who say, no, logging's not coming back, and what this area is more valuable for is the tourism industry, the commercial fishing, sport fishing, and things like that. And they say it's foolish to try to bring back a logging industry that's really gone.
We want to be clear that this is not a done deal. What are the next steps for this proposal?
Yeah, there's a 60-day comment period that kicks off now, and the final rule is expected next summer.
Liz Ruskin is Washington correspondent for Alaska Public Media. Liz, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Tanya. It's an honor.
And environmentalists are also reacting to this proposal. The Center for Biological Diversity says Alaska is already reeling from the effects of climate change. Clear-cutting old-growth trees in the Tongass National Forest would release significant amounts of carbon into the atmosphere and make things worse.
NBC News is facing increasing criticism after allegations in journalist Ronan Farrow's new book, Catch and Kill. Farrow won a Pulitzer Prize for his reporting in The New Yorker about sexual misconduct allegations against Hollywood producer Harvey Weinstein. But he began that reporting while at NBC and claims the network tried to stop it, afraid that Weinstein would reveal sexual misconduct allegations against NBC Today Show host Matt Lauer. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik has been following all of this. And David, Farrow alleges that Weinstein's friends were trying to dig up dirt on Matt Lauer to keep NBC quiet. Tell us more about that claim.
Right. Well, catch and kill is the idea of you catch stories and you kill them. Right. Part of Farrow's book focuses on AMI, the parent company of the National Enquirer, how they would catch stories and help him, help Harvey Weinstein basically stop them from getting to press. In this case, the allegation denied by Dylan Howard, the head of the National Enquirer, but nonetheless, the allegation is that the National Enquirer sent reporters out to make to inflict pain on NBC by trying to dig up dirt on Matt Lauer, its star. He had often been in the tabloids. There had been rumors and claims of marital infidelities, of affairs he had had. He's confirmed some of them since his departure, or at least having had some since his departure from the network. But this was represented in Farrow's book as a warning shot across the bow to NBC that, hey, we're going to dig up everything we can on your biggest star, your huge moneymaker, almost a $500 million a year in revenues the Today Show is for NBC, and we're going to inflict pain on you if you go after Harvey this way.
Well, and Farrow says that's why NBC News Chair Andrew Lack and NBC News President Noah Oppenheim tried to tamp down his reporting on Weinstein, which, by the way, would become, you know, the incredible reporting that launched the Me Too movement about Weinstein's behavior. So what's the network saying about that claim?
It says it's ludicrous to think that pressure from National Enquirer would or anyone else would cause them to shy away from the story. They report on reporting they've done at times, tough-minded reporting on sexual abuse allegations. They say, why would this one involving Harvey Weinstein be different? Farrow points to numerous calls that Weinstein made to NBC News executives, the top figures, NBC News Chairman Andy Lack, NBC News President Noah Oppenheim, MSNBC President Phil Griffin. NBC says in response, look, he called a bunch of times. Griffin took a number of the calls but wasn't really related to the reporting on the story. And Lack and Oppenheim each had a call in which they said, we'll get back to you if we need to give you comment on that. So NBC says, you know, this is less than might meet the eye. I think a lot of people look at this and say the difference between Harvey Weinstein and some of these other folks that NBC may have reported on is they didn't have access to friends at the National Enquirer. They didn't have these links. And so they may not have had a pressure point in terms of going after Lauer. That's the tension there.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's so much going on here. There's, as we said, the Me Too movement and how are, you know, women protected at an institution like NBC or people with claims of abuse or people with problems like Matt Lauer obviously had. But it's also journalism questions. You spoke with Rich McHugh, who's former supervising producer for the NBC News investigative team. He worked with Farrow. He left the network with Farrow. And he had this to say about NBC.
It doesn't make any sense that you'd let one of the biggest stories of the year, if not more, walk out the door like an investigation we've spent so many thousands of dollars on, just go, bye-bye, and we're going to let the New Yorker put the bow on our reporting.
Isn't that true that that's one of the damning things here? NBC says that it didn't feel the reporting was ready for air. It didn't pass its muster. That's what it said publicly. But 2 months later, it wins the Pulitzer.
That's right. In about 2 months, it's published in the New Yorker. Farrow had left, been allowed to by NBC News President Noah Oppenheim to take his reporting with him. McHugh stayed on for some months, left in 2018 with he felt basically his trust and heart broken over this story, which he felt was one of the defining ones of the era. This was good enough to be developed somewhat further by, under David Remnick at The New Yorker to really, you know, define the story and help propel, as you say, the Me Too movement. And I think there are a lot of questions within NBC among staffers I've talked to about their confidence in their leaders, both in terms of handling a story of this and in terms of handling their own problems, not just Lauer, but particularly Lauer. How well is the network thinking about this journalistically? How well is the network thinking about this as an employer?
And we only have a few seconds, but Farrow's gone, Lauer's gone. Any sense that Andrew Lack and Noah Oppenheim, the top managers, are, you know, there's pressure to push them out?
Well, it's funny. I asked that question for 4 days. Did they still retain the confidence of corporate leaders? There was 4 days of silence just moments ago, just before heading in the booth to talk to you here at NPR New York. I got a call from a senior spokeswoman at NBC Universal, the parent division of NBC News. They say that the news leaders retain the confidence of their corporate employers. But let's just say every person I talk to in NBC, before I even get a question out of my mouth, say, do you think Andy and Noah are going to be able to stay on? It's still in flux.
NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik, thank you.
You bet.
Well, pivoting here, 60 years ago, Philadelphia was the first city to create a Percent for Art program in America in which developers who acquire public land to build on are required to spend 1% of construction costs on public art. WHYY's Peter Crimmins reports it's become a model for other cities.
There are over 1,500 pieces of public art scattered around the city, plus more than twice that many murals, giving Philadelphia one of the largest collections of public art in the country. Over 600 of those pieces were created through the city's Percent for Art program. The public art is mostly sculptures and statues, but there are some more unusual things, like this public park in the Fairmount neighborhood. It's called Connections. It's a 2-acre city park designed in 1992 by the Greek-American artist Athena Tacha. She made a huge centerpiece with swirling tiers of plantings and arrangements of rock outcroppings. Rick Fry eats his lunch here almost every day. He's a teacher at the nearby community college, and he says the real beauty of Connections is the magical way it frames the skyline.
The stones, the way they're placed, depending on where you sit in the park, they mimic the skyline above it. So you'll be sitting there and it's like, wow, that just looks just like that new building that was built there, which is interesting because of the fact that it was built before a lot of the skyline was built.
The park was commissioned by the Franklin Town Corporation, mandated by the city when it built the surrounding neighborhood development. The Percent for Art program, administered by the Philadelphia Redevelopment Authority, was started in 1959. That was the era of Ed Bacon, the legendary city planner in Philadelphia, when he was aggressively redesigning the city's downtown. There was an urgency at the time to make sure that the rebuilt downtown was people-friendly. So says the current chair of the PRA, Gregory Heller.
It came from the Redevelopment Authority's chairman at the time, whose name was Michael von Moschisker. And he wrote, "We're under a particular obligation to make our cities places of which we can be proud."
There are actually two Percent for Art programs. The one run by the PRA is for commercial development, and there's another one run out of City Hall for public projects, like the Criminal Justice Center, built across the street from City Hall in 1994.
For this building, there was a $500,000 Percent for Art budget overall, so that was 1% of the city's total cost.
That's Margot Berg, the city's director of public art.
And so the Percent for Art program at that time commissioned multiple artists that created pieces that are really integrated into the architecture of the site.
Berg is standing in front of one of those commissions out on the sidewalk. It's a sculpture of a law library made with real books stretching 20 feet high. At the bottom, the artist Philip Simpkin made a bronze podium and lectern.
He sort of envisioned this piece as sort of a forum for people to talk about the American justice system.
Since Philadelphia established the Percent for Art concept 60 years ago, it's been adopted by many other cities, some of which do it better. So says a 2009 report by Harris Steinberg, then of the University of Pennsylvania. The report criticized the Percent for Art program for being weak. Steinberg, who's now with Drexel University, says there was little enforcement at the time against developers who flaunted the law.
It was easy to kind of skirt the regulations. There wasn't a big staff, there wasn't a big enforcement arm.
That report from 10 years ago recommended that the Percent for Art programs be more holistic. It should cut across many city agencies to better align with the city's urban planning goals. Gregory Heller, the chair of the PRA, says it's now moving in that direction.
One change that we made to the program fairly recently was to require each project to have a public education component. Developers take 5% of their 1% for art contribution and use it for public education.
To mark the 60th anniversary, the PRA and the city's Office of Arts, Culture, and the Creative Economy are encouraging people to go out and discover the Percent for Art art. A citywide scavenger hunt with an online interactive map will give out prizes to those who submit pictures of the artwork. For Here and Now, I'm Peter Crimmins.
Years after a gunman killed 49 people at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando, Florida, plans are now moving forward to build a museum and a memorial. But that plan is not moving without controversy. Danielle Pryor with member station WMFE has more.
I mean, you can see it. I mean, the architecture here, mm-hmm. here just looks all that you love.
Marilyn Bebe is walking around a room at the Orange County Regional History Center, carefully considering each of six wooden models. One of these designs will become the Pulse Memorial and Museum.
My kids, grandkids will know about him. You know, all the kids, people's kids will know about him. Friends and family members will know about him. It means a lot to me.
The person Bebe wants remembered is her son, Jason Benjamin Josephat, who was 19 when he was killed at the Pulse nightclub. She wants people to learn about her son, and she also wants them to remember the lives of all 49 people lost on June 12, 2016.
You know, every single one of them have a different background, and I want every one of them, everybody that visit the museum, the history, to learn about every single one of them.
In another corner of the room, Barbara Poma, the owner of the Pulse nightclub, is watching Bebe with a smile. Poma says this moment has been 2 years in the making. A year after the shooting, her nonprofit, One Pulse Foundation, sent out a survey asking the community what to do with the site. She says they overwhelmingly wanted a museum.
It is important that they want their stories told. They want this.
Poma says locals were split about whether to keep or demolish the nightclub, but she says all six of the final designs preserve the building because of what it represents to the larger LGBTQ community.
They've been to a gay bar in their community, which was their safe haven, where they got to come out, where they met their husbands or wives. They had their chosen families.
About an hour away in Lakeland, Florida, Christine Linenen wants to remember what happened at Pulse in a different way. Her son, Christopher Andrew Linenen, was 32 years old when he was killed at the nightclub. Linenen says she understands the appeal of preserving her son's memory, but she doesn't want the place where he was killed to become a tourist attraction that charges an entrance fee.
So they're using the shot-up building where my son was brutally murdered to bring people in who want to gawk at where my son was killed. That's obnoxious as a parent. It makes me angry.
She says she'd rather the nightclub be torn down completely, and the $10 million Orange County donated to the museum go toward helping survivors and victims' families.
Prior to going to Pulse that night, they had full lives. Now they have lives in pain, with PTSD, with surgeries.
A few months ago, Linenen started the Community Coalition Against a Pulse Museum to push back on One Pulse Foundation's plans to open a museum, memorial, and a survivor's walk in 2022. She and the members of the group, like Zachary Blair, are advocating for a memorial park instead. They say, unlike the museum, it would be free to the public. Blair grew up going to Pulse. He says both he and his partner knew people who died at the nightclub. He says their deaths and the experiences of people like them shouldn't be used for entertainment.
When the city of Orlando originally offered to buy the property from Barbara Poma, they planned to make a public memorial, and I think that's what should have happened. Instead, the owner has kind of turned this into a spectacle, and it's a very divisive project that's divided the community and continues to do so.
There's no template that says this is the one and only right way to do it.
That's George W. McDaniel. He's a historian who helped preserve mementos left behind after a shooter killed 9 people at the historically black Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina. He says that's where he learned there's no one way to respond to these events.
That may be through a prayer. It may be through a conversation with a stranger. It may be with the artifacts.
He says it's ultimately up to the Orlando community to determine how they'll memorialize those lost at Pulse, but also how they'll support those left behind, whether they choose to pursue a museum or not.
It's both and. I think you ought to do help survivors and their families and their victims and their families. I also think there ought to be some tangible mechanism or place that people could come to for years on end.
For now, amid an ongoing lawsuit against Poma brought by survivors and victims' families, claiming, among other things, that there wasn't enough security at the nightclub, plans to begin building the site in 2021 are moving ahead. That starts with a panel of survivors, victims' families, and architectural experts who will choose the winning design later this month. For Here and Now, I'm Danielle Pryor in Orlando.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.